Do faith and a workplace always mix? The Diversity Council of Australia has released an updated guide on multi-faith workplaces. That story soon. Hello, Kumi Taguchi here with the Religion and Ethics Report. I'm sitting in for Andrew West while he's on holidays. Let's start with the new polarising figure in Britain, and that's within his own party. Some Conservatives cherish the new Prime Minister Boris Johnson, others see him as an opportunist, and those who are not Conservative don't really know what to make of him. That includes Britain's religious leaders. Bruce Clark is the online religion editor for The Economist. He writes that the new Prime Minister's spiritual anecdotes and his present convictions are a bundle of contrasts and confusions.
I'm not implying that having mixed religious ancestry is in itself a bad thing, simply that what he's done with that ancestry is rather confusing. When he was Mayor of London, a very diverse city, as you know, he actually made a virtue of the fact that he had Muslim, Jewish, and Christian ancestors, and that was fine. But in fact, according to people who know him well, he's actually more attracted by the religion of ancient Greece and Rome than by any of those Abrahamic faiths.
So essentially using his background and his religious background sort of as political leverage rather than that's where he actually comes from, a sort of spiritual and ethical level.
Well, you can imagine that in London, great diversity went down rather well to be able to say that you had ancestors from all these different backgrounds. That was quite a selling point for Boris as Mayor of London. But I think that his biographer, Andrew Jimson, makes a very good point when he says that the really decisive influence on Boris was his school time at Eton, where he drank in the religion of ancient Greece and Rome, the classical religion, which makes a great virtue of the right of the hero to behave as he thinks best, to trample over conventional moral rules, to live life by omens and portents, this kind of thing. That's what really inspired Boris Johnson. And I think that he is quite attracted by the theory of the anti-Christian historian, Edward Gibbon, that Christianity had a kind of weakening effect on the late Roman Empire.
Interesting, because, you know, a lot of focus is on his religious background as opposed to this other sort of education at Eton. You know, christened a Catholic by his mother, he was confirmed in the Anglican faith, and he has, been known to visit the Western Wall in Jerusalem. He's spoken fondly of Jewish roots, so that has served him well to a point. But you're basically saying, on an actual fundamental human level, he doesn't act as if those are where his roots come from.
Well, clearly, having been to Eton, having attended Oxford, he's very, very familiar with the culture of Christianity, the culture of Anglicanism. So I wasn't at all surprised to find that when he was asked on a radio show how he would fare on a desert island, he said, well, I'd march up and down and sing hymns. And of course, he's speaking there of his Anglican background, the chapel at Eton, and I'm sure at a cultural level that left a mark on him. But I don't think that it really touched him existentially. I don't think it touched his heart, to be quite frank. And he wouldn't claim that either.
From a voter's perspective, how important is it, particularly when we're looking at our world becoming more secular, how important is it to have a leader who does, at least on the surface, tend to subscribe to, or as Boris Johnson describes himself, as a one-man melting pot when it comes to religion? Is that important these days?
Look, I don't think that many British voters are saying, let's assess Boris Johnson in terms of his religious background or his personal religious faith. I think opinion polls suggest that there is a correlation between being what I might call loosely Anglican and being in favour of Brexit. Oddly enough, people who are fervent Anglicans are not so much in favour of Brexit, but people who identify as Anglicans, perhaps more from a kind of patriotic, sentimental point of view than from a deeply religious point of view, they tend to be classic Brexit voters.
So on that level, would those voters then think, okay, we can see there's a little bit of Anglican in Boris Johnson, or at least that was where he was confirmed. Would that then give those Brexit voters a sense of security in Boris Johnson?
I think that Boris Johnson is a skillful enough politician that he can play that particular tune when it suits him. And she'll be perfectly at home, you know, at ceremonies in Westminster Abbey and whatever ceremonial duties go with being British Prime Minister, to the extent that they require him to be formally speaking an Anglican, he'll be quite happy with that.
So that chameleon-like approach, it sounds like it would be quite politically, well, quite convenient for him.
Yes. In a sense, his chameleon-like approach served him rather well when he was Mayor of London. You know, London is a city with so many communities that you have to be in touch with all of them and to celebrate their festivals and to make sure that they have a chance to contribute to the cultural life of London. And he was perfectly fine with that. Whether being such a chameleon will serve him well as Prime Minister remains to be seen. I mean, he has a great test in front of him, and simply being an accomplished chameleon won't be enough to get him through that test.
Let's talk about that test. I assume you're talking about the 31st of October when Boris Johnson has vowed that the UK will leave the EU bloc, a deal or no deal. How will he be tested, do you think, in your view? How is this going to go for him?
Well, this is a moment in British history. It's a moment that, at least in the short term, could have pretty dire consequences for the British economy. Most economists agree that the short-term effects of a no-deal Brexit will be pretty serious for the economy, for employment, for trade, and so on. And he will somehow have to guide Britain through that period if that's what he chooses to do.
In terms of the economic challenges as well, we've heard about this research from the Joseph Rowntree Foundation saying there's concern about rising poverty, for example. There could be at least 200,000 more people facing poverty and being pushed into poverty if there's a no deal. What are you hearing on those levels?
I can tell you that Justin Welby, the Archbishop of Canterbury, is personally worried about the social consequences of a no-deal Brexit. He even thinks that it's possible there will be riots in areas affected by a no-deal Brexit, a breakdown of public order. So in the faith community in Britain, that's it. No, there is certainly a concern that there will be quite serious short-term fallout from the dislocation and, you know, even the chaos, if you like, of a no-deal Brexit.
And what are those faith communities doing in anticipation of that?
A lot of British churches are already involved with poverty relief through food banks, for example. They campaign against the effects of gambling, licensed gambling in poor areas. So a lot of British churches are already committed to the anti-poverty struggle. The reach of the Anglican Church into the poorest areas of British cities is, you may say, not all that strong, given that, you know, historically Anglicanism has been sort of a church of the middle class in recent times. But I can tell you that Justin Welby is personally very, very committed to doing whatever he can morally and practically to ease whatever consequences there may be from the short-term effects of a no-deal Brexit.
Let's go to some of Boris Johnson's other links to different faiths. Now, Boris Johnson's great-grandfather was the Ottoman politician Ali Kemal, who was a Muslim, and admired England as the land of tolerance. A bit of a contradiction, given that some Muslim politicians actually resigned from the Tory party after Johnson became PM.
Yes, that's right. Ali Kemal is the most interesting figure from late Ottoman history. He was a newspaper editor and politician, very much on the liberal side of Ottoman politics, which was sometimes a dangerous place to be. And in fact, he suffered a terrible fate in the end. He was lynched by a mob because he got himself on the wrong side of the internal conflict of Turkey in late 1922. And most people would regard Ali Kemal, that's Boris Johnson's great-grandfather, as the ultimate sophisticated, relatively secular Turk. But in fact, on investigating his family history, Boris discovered that his great-grandfather, Ali Kemal, had gone through a very traditional Quranic education, which had included learning the Quran by heart. A very interesting Turkish antecedent Boris Johnson has. That doesn't mean that Boris automatically wins assent among today's Muslim community in Britain. In fact, some have been very offended by facetious remarks he's made. He said last year that, on one hand, he thought that under no circumstances should Islamic head covering or face covering be banned, because that was anti-libertarian. But nonetheless, he found it ridiculous that people should cover their faces completely, and indeed compared this form of apparel to letterboxes. So he's capable of some quite sharp language. Some British Muslims were offended by that.
You were mentioning before, Bruce, that you're not quite sure how this sort of great-grandfather connection will sort of play out in current politics and what it might mean for UK-Turkish relationships. I'm quite interested in this area, rural Anatolia. Now, this is the stronghold of right-wing parties. We also have a kind of Turkish connection to Boris Johnson, where residents of a small village of Kalfat, which is near Ankara, claim to be related to the new prime minister. So this Turkish connection comes up quite a bit. And now we've got this sort of stronghold of right-wing parties in a particular area of Anatolia. Would that raise questions or, in a sense, be an area where Boris Johnson might appeal to?
I think not. The main point about Boris's connection to Turkey is that he's connected to rather sophisticated people, Istanbul people. He has cousins who were in the Turkish diplomatic service. Yes, it's true that there is a connection via a maternal line with a place in the deep interior of Turkey. And indeed, there's a theory that the blonde hair might come from that particular connection, might be a connection with the Circassian race who were traditionally blonde. But actually, more immediately, Boris's Turkish connections are definitely city dwellers and highly educated and sophisticated people.
Bruce, finally, we've spoken a lot about the sort of chameleon-like nature of Boris Johnson, this kind of, not checkered, but a very sort of rich religious kind of history of him. And I've been trying to sort of try and define him, but it seems that he's sort of undefinable. Do we expect leaders in a way to fit into neat boxes? And when someone comes along who doesn't fit into that, we kind of scramble and try and figure out, you know, where are they coming from and what do they really think?
Well, I think British society is quite diverse, and of course London society, highly, highly diverse at the moment. The interesting thing with Boris is that while he was Mayor of London, he was able to make a virtue of his own sort of personal cultural diversity. He called himself a one-man melting pot. He's now appealing to Middle England and to a cohort of voters who are not so convinced of the infinite blessings of multiculturalism, and indeed many of them will have voted for Brexit, precisely because they think that Britain should define its own identity rather more sharply in the world, and it shouldn't be infinitely open to multicultural influences. So his latest gamble, and perhaps, you know, the last great gamble he'll make in his career, is to appeal to those who don't self-evidently regard his own hugely diverse background as a virtue. And so far he's succeeding, I have to say, that he has managed to persuade that cohort of Brexit-voting Middle England that he is their crusader, he is their man, their hero. But how long that act can go on, I'm not sure.
The Economist's online religion editor, Bruce Clark, joining me from Northern Ireland. And this is the Religion and Ethics Report.